I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Alan Gregerman. He is the founder of VentureWorks. He is also the author of The Wisdom of Ignorance, Why Not Knowing Can Be the Key to Innovation in an Uncertain World. And we're going to talk about that today. I think, if I understand correctly, we're going to learn how ignorance can actually be a strategic advantage. But he's a prolific writer, and he has 3 other books: The Necessity of Strangers, Surrounded by Geniuses, and Lessons from the Sandbox. Dr. Gregerman helps businesses with innovation. And I can think of a few that need that. Actually, I think we all need that. We should all be continually innovating. And so I think this is a good episode to tune into. Alan, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. Delighted to be here and delighted to share ideas about innovation and how everyone can unlock their own genius.
You know, I'm looking at the clock and we were having such amazing conversation in the green room. And, you know, I wish we had captured some of that, but it's been such a delight talking to you. And one of the things I discovered is we've both had significant physical setbacks.
Yeah, no, I was a bit surprised, of course, to learn about your bout with COVID. I'm delighted that you're doing well. You know, and I don't spend a lot of time talking about it, but 4.5 years ago, I had a pretty severe stroke and I lost the ability to see and speak. Kind of important abilities to have if you're a consultant and a keynote speaker and a workshop leader. And it took me about 18 months to kind of retrain myself to get those abilities back. I had really kind of great experts who helped me, but part of it was actually not knowing stuff, you know?
Well, let me interrupt there, because I'm thinking about when I woke up, I was incredibly frustrated because I had a trach.
Right.
And so I couldn't talk. And it was so frustrating trying to communicate with people, but at least I could see.
Right.
How did you communicate?
Well, so first I did kind of poorly, you know, and I think we all try and test limbs. I believed I was actually speaking. And as I had a bunch of speech therapists, their view was, no, you actually are kind of physically going through the motions, but you're not able to make an audible sound. I remember one of my speech therapists saying, somewhere in the Atlantic, there's a dolphin who can hear you, but humans can't hear you at all. And so I thought I was speaking, and people would say to me in varying degrees of kindly, you know, our older daughter, who I adore, is kind of snarky, and she would just scream, "We can't hear you. Just stop trying to speak." And it took months before I could make a sound that actually humans could hear. The fact that I couldn't speak and I couldn't see meant that I had to, with a chalkboard, write cryptic notes that probably were a mess, but it was the best I could do. It was based on memory. I was writing down things to kind of let people know what my needs were and what I was hoping to accomplish that day. It was interesting. You know, whatever doesn't kill you, they say, makes you stronger, you know, and, you know, you have no choice. You just keep moving forward. And I think that's kind of a lesson that I've learned about business is even during tougher, challenging times, and we live in uncertain times, you just keep moving forward. I think that's what you do.
You know, I don't think people who haven't experienced it can appreciate how frustrating it is when you're trying to communicate, you feel like you're being coherent, and nobody can understand you. It's It's, and again, I at least had the benefit of vision, but they gave me a letter card at one point, and I was trying to spell out letters, and my wife said it was gibberish.
Right.
And it's just so incredibly frustrating that in your head, I don't know if this is what you felt, in your head, everything you're saying is reasonable and logical and understandable, but nobody understands you.
Yeah, no, so I experienced that. The plus I had, I think, was I'm like a future person. So the here and now frustrations were less kind of important to me than my belief that at some point I was going to speak again and then I was going to get back at all these people who tormented me. But no. So I sat on the porch kind of imagining what life was going to be like when I got my abilities back together. And when you can't see or speak, you hear bird sounds that you didn't hear before. You know, we wander around and there's so much going on that we miss because we're either in our own heads or we're having a conversation with someone. So it was fine. You know, in retrospect, it was absolutely fine. The fact that doctors, experts initially said they didn't know if I'd ever speak again, that was frustrating. The fact that my therapist showed up, you know, parked in the driveway and said, okay, we're going to do a lot of exercises. You're probably not going to make a sound for weeks or months, but they're going to work. I believe in you. You're going to be speaking. I'm not coming here for you not to speak again. You know, so I had the balance of people who were super highly trained, other people that were still pretty highly trained who believed in me. And, you know, my only option was to believe in myself.
Yeah, and for those that don't know the lingo, when you say therapist, you're not talking about a counselor, you're talking about your speech therapist.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I had speech therapists, vision therapists, occupational therapists. I mean, more therapists than I realized prior to the stroke even existed. But, you know, go back to what you were saying because it's pretty important. You know, it's an interesting lesson to be trying to talk and not speak. And I guess that an awful lot of your listeners who lead organizations often are frustrated because they think they've said something and the company or organization, all their people either interpret it wrong or just didn't get the message at all. And so, for me not to be able to get anybody to hear a word I was saying challenged me to think about how do you really communicate with people and how do you make sure you're all on the same page?
And that's a really interesting perspective as you're throwing it out there, because what I hear, if I'm hearing you correctly, I'm hearing you say the responsibility to communicate's on your shoulders, not the shoulders of whoever you're trying to communicate to.
Oh, yeah. So I had to figure out, and you know, I went through iterations and they were cryptic, but I had to figure it out. One of the other challenges, once you've had a significant stroke, is they put you on a high level of blood thinners. So here's a guy now who's used to walking and exercising. He can't see and he can't speak, but he needs to get his exercise. And so I cryptically write on a chalkboard to my wife, I would like to walk today. Can you find a neighbor or a friend or a customer who's willing to walk with me? And they have to hold my arm to make sure I don't fall because if I fell and cut myself, I could bleed to death. So you figure out how to communicate with what tools you have, and over time, you just hope you're going to get better at it.
You know, and obviously it's such a challenging experience, but my guess is you came out as a better communicator once your ability to see and speak returned. I would guess that you were a much more effective communicator on the other side of the stroke than you were on the front side.
Well, so a couple of things. One is customers now, I do a lot of keynote speaking. Customers say, gee, you know, that stroke was really good. You slowed down the way you spoke. You used to speak so fast, and our people were really scurrying to take notes. And now they actually can kind of pause and listen to you. So I think that was good. The other thing is, when you have to work hard to get your needs met, when you have to work hard to figure out how to get a message to somebody, it does resonate with you. And so I think part of the lingering benefit is that I try to always be clear with the customers I work with family and friends, that my communication is on target, you know, and I don't think I thought about that as much before I lost the ability to communicate.
Yeah. Wow. That's, I mean, I'm just, it's still, I'm a little bit overwhelmed. I experienced not being able to speak, and that was extremely frustrating. But to not be able to see on top of that, that's just so amazing what you've been through and how you've come out on the other side.
Well, you don't have a lot of choices, do you? So I wanted to get back into my life, of course. I wanted to get back to running my business, which I've been running for 37 years. So I was doggedly determined. And again, because I'm a future thinker, which I think is an asset in the work that I do, I'm always trying to think about what's next. I was in my mind thinking about I'm going to get through this and figure it out. Didn't think it was going to take 18 months to figure it out. But yeah, I was totally focused on that. And another thing I did, which was I think really good while I couldn't see or speak, is I listened to books on tape. So a friend of mine got me a subscription to Books on Tape and said, just listen to stuff, keep your brain going. And I think that was really helpful. And so I think when I think about our customers, we always need to keep learning new things. And so I was doggedly determined to do this. But I always say to my customers, when you got a free moment, learn something new, think about the world differently, imagine where your business could be going. And that's been really helpful to me, that whole idea. So just listening to stuff, I actually became pretty smart while I lost these abilities. Probably read a lot more than I read now.
Well, and there's actually some science behind that. There's this region of the brain called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex. And it's the only part of the brain that will actually grow. And the only way to make it grow is to do things that are outside your comfort zone.
Interesting.
And it's responsible for emotional regulation. It's responsible for delivering what's, I think it's what triggers dopamine, the things that make you feel satisfied and what have you. And so you got like a prolonged period of being outside. That your anterior mid-cingulate cortex must be massive. And the reward center of the brain, that's the what I was looking for. It's responsible for the reward center of the brain. And because you faced that and took on the challenge, the rewards that your brain gave you were multiplied.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping. We always like to think that we're becoming smarter and more remarkable. I'm not sure that's the case, but I really felt I came out of the stroke kind of energized. I tell you, the first time after like 4 months that I actually made a sound that a human could hear, I felt awesome. The first time I was able to start seeing, which was really weird, because I had such a bad case of double vision that I saw a doctor and straight ahead of me, and I saw another one of them like 12 feet to the right. And I had to ask doctors which was the real one. Were they on the one on my left or on my right? But each time I kind of made progress, I felt really good. And the fact that I was continuing to use my brain really made it so that when I suddenly was able to kind of come back to life and come back to work, I still felt pretty energized that I wasn't out of touch.
Well, let's pivot and talk about your book. I mean, this is fascinating. We could spend a whole hour talking about this. I love your journey. But your book, The Wisdom of Ignorance, what an awesome title. But what are you saying? What's the nutshell?
No, I appreciate the question. So I wrote this book because I've been an innovation consultant for 37 years. And one of the frustrations for me has always been that while companies talk about innovation, most have absolutely no idea how to make innovation happen. Most companies think when they need to come up with a brilliant idea, they bring the smartest people into a room, people who are expert, and they ask them what they think. But experts are people who have trained to kind of help us be successful now, not necessarily in the future or an uncertain world. So imagine this. The reality is, innovation happens when we actually are willing to kind of step back from our expertise and look at the world with fresh eyes. And that's what this book is really about. So I like to say kind of two things that I'd love your listeners to think about. The first is the notion that if I know a lot, I can make things better. I know the ins and outs of our product or our service or our solution. So I know how to tweak it to make it better for customers. If I don't know much, I take a fresh look at what we're doing and say, in a fast-changing world, should we be doing this or should we be doing something different? That's the first thing. The second thing is what I call the 99% rule. Most companies bring people together in a room with whiteboards and post-it notes and all kinds of things. And they say, okay, We need to have an out-of-the-box idea. Does anybody here have one? And that presupposes that we have to reinvent the wheel every time. Turns out 99% of all new ideas are based on someone else's thinking or something found in nature. And so the people who innovate put ideas together that already exist with their own secret sauce. And so companies don't really understand that. And so the wisdom of ignorance is basically saying, actually get out there and engage the world. Approach every problem as though you could start anew and think differently about it, and look for ideas and inspiration all around you as the starting point. Don't sit in a room and rack your brain.
It reminds me, so I make furniture, not as much recently as in the past, but I took a design class by a guy named Michael Fortune, who makes his living designing furniture for five or six households in North America. So he makes very expensive furniture, and his stuff is gorgeous. And he stood up and he said, "You know what? I'm not an Einstein, neither are any of you." And he showed us a process where he was doing exactly what you were telling. What you were saying. He would steal ideas from nature. Or there's one coffee table he made that just has this one beautiful inward swept legs. And he said, "I found this Egyptian vase in a museum. It's been in the museum for thousands of years. I don't know why it's beautiful, but people for thousands of years have judged it to be beautiful. So I just traced the outline of the vase, and that was the shape of the leg."
Yes, so no, I think he's kind of spot on. So think about the great architect Frank Gehry. And so Frank Gehry's work, and it's found in Chicago and Los Angeles and Prague and all kinds of places, is based on actually deconstructing geometry as opposed to using geometry. So think about a building typically being rectangular and of a certain dimension. And so Gehry says, why don't we take this and kind of curve these ideas? Why do buildings have to have straight edges on it? And so his work is kind of brilliant. He's kind of highly in demand and a genius. But I want people to think about they should regularly be deconstructing what they do and figuring out is there a better way to do it? And the key reason to do that is because customers demand more of us. They're always going to demand more of us. And so folks might say, well, my customers are happy with what I give them now. Actually, not. They just don't know a better way. And so our job is to figure out a better way, something else to give them. And so your friend who's actually going out and looking around, he knows one of the clues. And that is, if I want to be brilliant, I should get out and wander around and look for ideas. Remember, as we sit in our offices, the world is passing us by. The world keeps moving and changing, and we need to get out there and see what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and as you were talking, I was like, that happened to me today. I have a co-working place where I work, and it has this lovely courtyard with live oaks that are hundreds of years old. And I got up, and as I started walking, I had to pull my phone out to start capturing all the ideas that came to my head.
Well, so I think, so I think about most people who are listening to this probably say to themselves, I'm not particularly innovative. And the reality is, sitting in an office or sitting in a cube, or if you're working remotely, sitting at your dining room table doesn't make you feel particularly creative. But getting out and paying attention and seeing connections and suddenly understanding how the world works, both the human-made world and the natural world, suddenly makes everybody believe, wow. This is kind of cool, or here's an idea I have. Think about it, walking in nature. So Velcro wasn't invented in a laboratory by some guy wearing a lab coat who was farting around with ideas for how to create a perfect hook system. Velcro was invented by a guy walking his dog in the Alps. And one day he saw his dog was covered with burrs. And as opposed to saying, God, these are a pain in the neck, he took some off of his dog and looked at them under a microscope and saw that they had little hooks. He said, I can think of a zillion ways I can use those as a regular person. Today, there are about 100,000 applications of Velcro because a guy took a walk with his dog and paid attention.
I never knew that story. That's fascinating. So let me kind of go back to the title. And it was something that you mentioned in the green room that sometimes coming from a place of ignorance is a strategic advantage.
Well, yeah. So think about it. And I'm guessing your listeners, if they think about this and think about their companies or organizations, will get this pretty quickly, even though it's a counterintuitive idea. The notion is quite simple, and that is if I don't know a lot, I look at things with fresh eyes. It's the only way I can start to make sense of them. And when I look at them with fresh eyes, I start to imagine all kinds of possibilities. So let me give you, I know you're in Texas, let me give you a great example. Two guys, Herb Kelleher and Roland King, are sitting at a bar in San Antonio. And one of them says, you know, airlines are kind of expensive and they're not very efficient. Let's take a napkin out here and draw a picture of a different type of airline, one that everybody could fly on, just like taking the Greyhound bus. And so they draw a picture. Kelleher's a lawyer. King is an amateur pilot, but he doesn't do that at all. He'd never been in the airline business. And they draw a map between San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston, the three largest cities in Texas. And they said, what if we created an airline that didn't make you go to a big hub first? It took you wherever you wanted to go. And now let's talk about it being efficient. We wouldn't have assigned seats. We'd use the same type of airplane. We'd give people peanuts. Remember the peanut fares? They relayed later, when asked, why did you start an airline? They said, well, you know, we didn't know anything about airlines. We just thought we were smart. We could figure out a better way. And if we'd known a lot about airlines, we never would have started one. What they started was Southwest Air. Until a few glitches, Southwest Air, most popular airline in America, started by guys who knew nothing about the airline business. So the reality is all around us. I'd love for your listeners to think about things they use today that were started by people who knew nothing about what they were doing. How many people call an Uber or get Uber Eats? Uber was started by two friends in Paris who couldn't find a cab. They realized, talk about the 99% rule, that GPS was now a thing. They decided to take the idea of cabs and the idea of global positioning systems and bring people who needed a ride together with people who had a ride to give, and that's how Uber started. Airbnb wasn't started by people who had any experience in the hospitality business. Spanx, some of your listeners might use Spanx, underwear that doesn't show that makes you feel better about yourself. She was a fax machine salesperson going door to door. So think
Wow.
about that. So Sarah Blakely, she was doing two things that don't even exist today, fax machines and door to door selling. And yet she decided, you know, I gotta feel better. I gotta look better. Maybe somebody else has this problem. $1 billion problem, okay? So the reality is the world abounds with all these ideas. People who didn't know what they were doing, who looked at the world with fresh eyes because no one had solved the problem, create really significant opportunities.
Well, I 20 years ago, I was working in the mobile phone industry, and a company that had never made a mobile phone changed the entire industry. And one of the debates was, why do we, for the original iPhone, one of the debates was, well, we're going to need a keyboard. And so Steve Jobs and his team made the first smartphone that didn't have a keyboard. And it almost didn't have a SIM card. I mean, but that's how the team managed to convince Steve Jobs. Jony Ive and Steve Jobs both agreed that SIM cards were stupid and he didn't want it in their phone. And somebody fortunately convinced him to put that in. But it was coming in and just challenging the assumptions, coming in from a place of ignorance instead of saying, of course we're going to do this because smartphones have keyboards.
Well, yeah, so think about it. Who were the folks who really launched the mobile phone industry? That was Nokia. At a
Right.
point, Nokia had a 49% market share. They thought of a phone as a phone. You called people. They never imagined that today's phones could have the computing power of a university computer center in the 1980s, okay? So
Yeah.
I now have the ability to do that. But they didn't think about the notion that this could be the all-in-one device that I could literally live my life, and you only need to get on a bus or sit in a park downtown or be on a subway in a city that has a subway to see 95% of people on their phones all the time. So you can bet they're using it kind of for their lives. But it took a vision that anything was possible, right? It wasn't just a mobile phone. It was anything. And look at the hundreds of thousands of apps you can download on your phone. Now the phone becomes a canvas for incredible creativity.
Yep. I know for myself, I'll mention this every now and then when I'm working with a client, is one of the benefits I have that I bring to them is I'll ask the stupid questions because I don't know better. And I'll just ask a question that maybe in that industry seems stupid. Well, why don't we do this? And inevitably, it ends up unlocking an opportunity that most have ever looked.
If they're open to that, right? And so sometimes they get stuck because they have too much expertise, but you're exactly right. If they're open to being different and open to thinking in new ways, suddenly you've created a window. You're just exposing them to new ideas. But think about this. It used to be, and I have a little bit more gray hair than some of your audience, but it used to be that the expectation was you'd take a job, you'd stay there for 5 years, you'd pay your dues, and then you could offer your opinion, right? I suggest to all of our customers that the people they want to ask for their opinions are the absolute newest people in the organization. So the day someone arrives, instead of putting them through orientation, we should ask them what they know, not tell them what we know. Why? Because they've been somewhere else, right? And so they've seen other practices. Because they're also out there in the world, and we're not in the world. We're here in our factory or in our offices. And so the idea of having a fresh perspective is so profoundly valuable to us in a world changing fast, and we need to look for all the opportunities to do it. I
I
also
have
think,
a,
oh, go ahead.
oh no, and for those that that are stuck, I have absolutely, you said for those that are open to thinking differently. So one of the favorite statements I have when somebody says to me, well, that's not how it's done in our industry. I have a way of absolutely shutting that down. And I ask them, I said, is your goal to be average? And nobody wants to be average. No, we're exceptional. We're exceptional every way. I said, if we limit ourselves to the way it's done in your industry, mathematically, we're limiting ourselves to average. If we're going to
Oh,
be
yeah.
extraordinary, we have to do it a way differently than what others are doing in your industry.
Oh, no, so you're exactly right. So let me give you an example. Many years ago, I was invited by one of the largest banks in America to help them think about customer service. By all rankings, they were among the worst in customer service of the 20 largest banks in America. I show up, and the CEO, really excited, gives me a McKinsey study. And the McKinsey study talks about the leading customer service practices of banks in America. And he says to me, what do you think of this? And I said, well, you just spent $2 million to figure out how to be the best of the worst. And he pauses for a moment and then says, what do you mean? And I said, are banks renowned for providing great customer service? And he says, no, actually, we're pretty bad at it. So I said, so instead of benchmarking banks, you should go to Nordstrom or the Ritz-Carlton Hotel or somebody else where they're really good and figure out what they know and then apply that to banking. We came up with a plan that was awesome. It actually included banks being open 7 days a week, banks being open till 8 o'clock at night, banks providing financial education not only to their customers but their children. We came up with an awesome plan. The board refused to approve it. One of the people who was sitting there went to work for a bank called Commerce Bank, the world's kind of most convenient bank. Commerce Bank took all these ideas and actually ran with them and became, in the New York metropolitan area, by far the most popular bank. So I think you're spot on. Kind of people also look in the wrong places for ideas and inspiration. They're not open to the world being a kind of a place with ideas, and so they tend to say, who's good in our industry? And you're exactly right. That's not good enough. We can't win tomorrow by being the best in our industry, better than the other people in our industry. We win tomorrow by being the best in our industry because we're the best in the world at what we do.
Yeah. Well, and something hit me. I was talking to somebody about this earlier. Stealing from other industries. So we do marketing. We steal from television. We have a client, we just took on a new client where it's a mom and daughter team, and the daughter's like, I don't want to be on camera. I don't want to be on the website. I don't want to be seen. And I paused and I thought about it. I was like, I've seen this formula before. There was a TV show called Home Improvement with Tim Allen, and he had a neighbor called Wilson. And you never saw anything above Wilson or anything below Wilson's nose. I was like, it's a proven formula. I don't have to be innovative. I don't have to be a genius. I just have to be smart enough to see a pattern that was used somewhere else and pull it in. And I know it's a winning formula. I don't know why it's a winning formula, but I know it's a winning formula.
Well, no, but I'd use a slightly different word, and I know exactly where you're going, but I wouldn't say steal from other industries. I'd say learn from other industries, because the reality is I'm going to learn from them, I'm going to adapt it to my world, and I'm going to create kind of compelling value. And so, I don't want people to think that innovation's about stealing. I want people to think about innovation's about being curious, about looking at a world filled with ideas and then figuring out which of these ideas can we use as the starting point for us to be remarkable.
No, and I like that. And I would say I'm certainly using the word steal a little bit too liberally. It's
You're in
the
marketing. Come on, you like that word now.
Well, I think there's an element of pride that you have to overcome. I think it's hard to be a proud person and an innovative person at the same time. And because the proud person says, I have to come up with the idea. I have to be the genius of it, of that. And kind of coming back to the title of your book, there's a strategic advantage to being the ignorant one in the room.
So think about this. Leaders need to tell people it's okay not to know the answer right now, but to work together to figure out a more brilliant answer. So I don't talk about ignorance as stupidity. I talk about ignorance as really the kind of ticket that allows us to go out and come up with a new idea. And that's what I'm all about in the work I do with companies and organizations. So I want people to think about we should be sanctioned to be okay with not knowing a lot now, but we quickly have to figure out something. Then the other thing you've talked about is really important, and that is we're going to come up with a brilliant idea, but it's not going to be just starting from scratch with a blank sheet of paper. We're going to come up with a brilliant idea by finding brilliant ideas and adapting them to our world. And
There's the word I was looking, not steal, but adapt.
And so that's really vital to our success is to constantly be out there looking and seeing how the world is moving and take some of these ideas and use them as the starting point for us to be more brilliant. We're still the creators of what we do in our business, but we don't have to start at square zero. We start at square one, two, or three. Other people have figured out a lot of stuff.
Okay. Well, hey, and maybe this would be kind of a good way to kind of wrap up. The if I remember correctly, you said there are six element, it's a six element formula to how we unlock our genius. What are those six elements?
Perfect. Yeah. And so, what I want people who are listening, if they're leaders, to understand is they need to create a culture that's all about these six things. If I'm an individual, I want you to think about that you have to master these six skills in order to be valuable to your company or organization in the future. Here's what they are. The first is we have to be purposeful. And so, the reality is, we think of innovation as anybody got a brilliant idea. Actually, innovation is this is what we're trying to accomplish. Let's come up with brilliant ideas to solve it. So we have to have a clear purpose. The folks who have a clear purpose, they win. The second is we have to be curious. So we've talked a lot about it, and that is the folks in the organizations that win actually are curious about the world around them. They're curious about ideas. They're asking customers questions all the time. They're getting out and engaging the world. The third is we have to be humble. It used to be a kind of not a good look for a leader to say, I actually don't know the answer. But the reality is, collectively, we don't know the answer yet, but we're going to figure it out. And so humility allows us to say, let's figure out how to make this happen. The fourth is, I need to be respectful. I need to respect every single person in every place where an idea could come from. And so that's vitally important to me. Oftentimes, as you were saying, we tend to look at the usual places when we're looking for ideas, and we tend to think, oh, these people, they're not in my industry, they don't understand. They're in another culture, they don't understand. The reality is we have to respect everybody because we can learn something from everybody else. The fifth is we have to be future focused. The reality is the world is changing so fast. If I'm not paying attention or thinking regularly about where the world's going to go, I'm not going to be the first one to get there. And so all the people listening have to figure out, how do I beat everybody else to the place my customers and the world are getting to? And the last one, which is, I want to say a little bit controversial, at least to my wife, is we all have to be a bit paranoid. You know, and so you say that word and people go, what do you mean by that? And I say this. We have to behave as though somebody's always following us and somebody's trying to eat our lunch. If I'm paranoid, then I know I got to keep a step ahead of all of the monsters in the closet or all of the potential competitors. And it just pushes me to compress the clock and think differently. So if we can master those six things, we can remain as individuals relevant and our companies can be even more compelling in the future.
I love that. I love that. So the book is coming out. When's it coming out and where can people get it?
Yeah, so it's coming out October 14th, and it's already up on Amazon. It's called The Wisdom of Ignorance. I have to be honest, it's one of my favorite books. No, but seriously. So it's coming out October 14th. It should be widely available then if they prefer a local bookstore, and I like local bookstores, and that bookstore is not carrying it, they can ask the bookstore to order it and get it for them. But it should be kind of available everywhere. And so I'm hoping to see people in airports reading it and people in conference rooms reading it. And, you know, if people want more information, just connect with me.
And how can people connect with you?
Well, so people can connect with me by going on LinkedIn and connecting with me, Alan Gregerman. They can go to alangregerman.com, which is my website. They can send an email to innovate at venture-works.com. That's my company email. They can find me.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thanks for sharing this on Leaders and Legacies. What valuable lessons for every business to implement.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm delighted to be here and appreciate the chance to share ideas with you and your audience.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.